More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Tyke. The news continues to sink in that Ryan Braun will sit out the rest of this season after being suspended by Major League Baseball for involvement with performance-enhancing drugs. And his suspension will likely not be the last handed out as baseball continues to probe the now-shuttered Florida anti-aging clinic called Biogenesis. The Braun case is also, obviously, not the first in which a high-profile athlete has been nabbed for using performance-enhancing substances. In fact, their use goes back well before the high-profile cases we can think of in recent memory. Back in 2008, we spoke with Dan Rosen, author of the book Dope, A History of Performance Enhancement in Sports from the 19th Century to Today. He said the history of PED use in sports goes back much further than you probably even realize.
It's been going on for at least 100, 125 years, and there's even some legends or stories of performance enhancement use in the original Greek Olympics several millennia ago.
But without any firsthand accounts of those, we're forced to talk about the 19th century as maybe the start of this. What form did the earliest stages of performance enhancement take?
Well, it starts with performance enhancement, both positive and negative, for racehorses. In the early to mid-19th century, when people started wagering on horse races, there became the temptation on the part of certain individuals to fix the outcome. At the time, the security on the stables wasn't all that good, so somebody could get in there, and if they wanted a horse to lose, they could give it a drug that would sedate it. And if they were trying to get the horse to win, they could give it a drug that might make it go faster. So that's where it begins. And then it sort of works its way into track and field and swimming and cycling all at about the same time. Various runners came into contact with horse trainers, and those people started learning performance enhancement techniques. Some of those, like Choppy Warburton, became a trainer to cyclists and used some of those same techniques, things like early forms of stimulants like cocaine, heroin, and later on amphetamines in the 1920s or so, to boost people's performance.
And of course, in those days, there was a fair amount of, if you will, alchemy that was kind of going into this.
Very much so. Warburton especially is cited a number of times, where he had a little black bottle that he would take to the races where his cyclists would be competing. And nobody's 100% sure what was in that black bottle, but they would seem to do better after taking a sip or two.
Well, and as you talked about with horse racing, what really seems to have been the catalyst for all this is the economics, both of the drug-making industry and the money that's at stake for many of the athletes. How much of the rise of doping do you think is linked to today, the 7- and 8-figure salaries that go along with some pro sports, but really the what was at stake, the money that athletes could make?
I think that has a lot to do with it. When you have a sport, whether it's cycling or football or baseball or soccer, where the line between the people who can make a lot of money and the people who are also rans is very fine, then you find people tempted to use various methods of cheating in order to make it across the line and get into the show and to make the big money.
Right. If it would sort of be one thing if it was just these athletes' competitive natures coming out, but this is competition plus a lot of money.
Yeah, it's a lot of both. The competitive nature being what it is, there's always people who are willing to take a shortcut. And the fact that there is some fairly serious money, especially in the big league sports, certainly prompts people to use performance-enhancing drugs.
Not that the various types of doping out there today don't have their risk, but some of the earliest techniques in the early half of the 20th century were really pretty risky.
Yeah, extremely risky. Tom Hicks, who won the 1904 marathon in St. Louis, which goes down on record as the slowest ever Olympic marathon,
They were running through the streets,
right,
and on you know, like dirt tracks at some points.
Exactly, on a very hot day. They back then they didn't even know that starting in the heat of the day at 2 or 3 in the afternoon in St. Louis at the end of August would be a very problematic thing. But you know, here they're the runners are going along. There's cars kicking up dust. There's heat. There's all sorts of problems. And back then, they thought, well, you know, a little bit of strychnine and brandy and raw eggs can get you through. And, you know, strychnine is basically rat poison. It's a stimulant, to be sure, but this man barely crawled across the finish line. He probably didn't crawl, but he barely got across the finish line before he collapsed. And it took several hours for him to revive. And interestingly, Hicks never competed after that, ever again.
And so we flash forward a few decades, and before any of the most recent controversies, you had the Eastern Bloc teams, especially East Germany, Olympic teams, who are always reputed to be using performance enhancers and earned that reputation, honestly or dishonestly, depending on how you put it.
The old-fashioned way. They definitely earned it.
What exactly were they doing in those days to get the competitive edge? What were the performance enhancers?
In the 50s through the 70s, the big performance enhancers were testosterone and some of the derivatives like Dianabol. The Russians especially, and then the East Germans and other East Bloc countries, experimented a great deal with these types of drugs, but they started with sports that involve strength. So like with the weightlifting. And it back in the early 50s, that's when it really started to take on some usage in the East Bloc. Interestingly, an American coach named Ziegler ran into a Russian coach in the mid-1950s, and the Russian asked him, "So what are your guys using?" And started telling him about testosterone. And it was Ziegler who, with SIBA, the pharmaceutical company, actually developed Dianabol. At the same time, the East Germans were experimenting not only just with weightlifters, but with track and field athletes, the ones doing shot put and things like that. There was a young woman named Brigitte Berendonk who was in the East German sports schooling system in the mid-50s as, I believe, a shot putter. And they were encouraging her and some of her teammates to take these little blue pills, which they identified as vitamins, same kind of little blue pills that in the 70s the East German women's swim team would be taking. So that's the kind of things that were going on in the 50s to the 70s. Steroids were slowly filtering out, and they eventually made it into American weightlifting and in the early 60s into football and the later 60s into baseball.
And you just alluded to pro football. Steroids started to find their way in the 60s, and
yep.
Possibly one of the better-known examples, people have talked about the Pittsburgh Steelers of the 1970s.
Right. The Super Steelers were said to be on steroids, or at least some of them. I don't know that the whole team was. Several of the players in the late 70s admitted, not in the late 70s, but from that era admitted, that they used steroids. But even before that was the 1963 San Diego Chargers, where one of Ziegler's associates became the strength and conditioning coach, and he brought Dianabol to the Chargers. And some of the people who were involved in the Chargers organization eventually moved out to some of the other football teams, including the Steelers.
The Olympics have also had plenty of controversies. We talked about the various East German teams, for
yep.
example, but some Americans, including a swimmer in 1972, got caught up in the whole performance
right.
enhancing controversy, and maybe for the wrong reasons.
Oh, definitely for the wrong reasons. Rick DeMont is the swimmer you're talking about, and he was a star in, I believe it was the 1500 meter freestyle, and very fast swimmer. He had an asthma problem. I don't know if he still does, but he was taking some medication for asthma, and he had actually properly informed the U.S. Olympic Committee through the proper paperwork that he was taking this asthma medication. And the night before one of his meets, he took a puff on an inhaler or whatever it was, didn't think anything of it because he was having some breathing problems. And the next day he took a little more of the medication. And after the event, which he won, he tested positive for
pseudoephedrine, right?
Right, for pseudoephedrine. And they basically stripped him of his medal, gave it to an Australian swimmer who he had just barely outtouched, and then banned him from the rest of the Olympics. But it turns out it was the U.S. Olympic Committee that had failed to send the paperwork onwards. And so this swimmer, through no fault of his own, lost his medal. And it took 29 years, I believe, before the U.S. Olympic Committee finally admitted, well, we made a mistake. We're sorry. And the International Olympic Committee, even though the USOC has said, yeah, we made a mistake, they've stuck by their guns. They've said, that happened, and we're not going to change the result. We're going to still leave the Australian as the winner of that race. We're not going to give any sort of retrospective award or any sort of certificate saying we're sorry.
That's a 2008 interview with Dan Rosen, author of Dope, A History of Performance Enhancement in Sports from the 19th Century to Today. One last break, and then we'll chat with writer Jen Lancaster, who spent a year channeling her inner Martha Stewart. We'll find out what that was like when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio.